This is Digital Story Podcast number 568, January 24th, 2017. Today's theme is Why Churchill's Portrait Was Burned. I'm Derek Story. When a subject allows us to photograph them, they are putting their hearts in our hands. And the decisions that we, the photographer, make in those moments together bear great weight on the final outcome. Is it our goal to solely please the subject? Do we have a responsibility to integrate our own artistic vision into the work? Or should we ignore the desires of others and portray what we believe to be honest? I grapple with these questions in today's show. So let me tell you the story of Winston Churchill's portrait for his 80th birthday. And I first became aware of this story watching The Crown on Netflix, which is a terrific series. I just love the way that it's written and acted. And in episode number 9 of The Crown, they actually talked about this. I believe the episode is called Assassins. So I did a little bit more research because I didn't know this story before I saw this episode on The Crown. And I thought it was very interesting, and I thought that a lot of what went on in this interaction between Churchill and the painter actually is relevant to us as photographers, as us people who take pictures of other people. And, you know, some of the things that go on, you know, behind all of that. So I'll get into that in a few moments, but right now, let me bring you up to speed. If you haven't seen episode 9 of The Crown, let me bring you up to speed on the story of Churchill's portrait for his 80th birthday. The House of Commons and the House of Lords commissioned a formal portrait by modern painter Graham Sutherland. The painting, when completed, showed Churchill seated in a chair with his hands resting on his arms, with him slightly slumped and portrayed in dark, wintry tones. Now, Churchill hated this painting. Sutherland argued that he had painted what he honestly had seen. During its public unveiling, Churchill quipped that it was, quote, a remarkable example of modern art, which was not a compliment. The painting was never hung in public, and as the story goes, it was hidden away in the cellar of their Chartwell estate. Until the middle of one unparticular night, when it was smuggled out and burned. Years later, when Sutherland learned of the destruction of his work, he claimed to have said, without question, an act of vandalism. So who was right in this? Winston Churchill, who had tried to guide the artist towards a more flattering portrayal, but upon failing to do so, chose to destroy the work? Or Graham Sutherland, who, despite pressure from his subject, stuck to his beliefs that his responsibility was to show the famous statement as he truly looked in his 80th year? Now, as I thought about this, I thought it really comes down to a question of honesty and how we interpret honesty. In other words, is honesty only what we see on the surface when we're taking a portrait, when we're making a portrait? Or should we as artists consider the human being beneath the surface when making our choices how to portray them? So I just loved thinking about this because this ties into a lot of what I think about when doing portrait work. Now, obviously, not every portrait is the same. For example, if I'm hired by a business to do a business portrait, let's say of someone on their executive team, then all I'm really doing then is trying to conform to the styles of their brand and give them a portrait that fits with all the other portraits that are hanging on the wall, right? So that is not an artistic experience for me. That is an experience where I use my technical skills to provide the client with what they want. But there are many other instances where I have people who are writers, who are actors, who do all sorts of various, you know, jobs in life, who want a portrait that really conveys who they are. So that when someone goes to the bio page on their site or about the author leaf on the inside book jacket or wherever it happens to be, that image portrays that person as that person would like to be portrayed. And I think this is an interesting question, and this is why I love, you know, the story of what happened to Winston Churchill and Graham Sutherland. Because let's take the book author portrait that's going to be on the inside of his or her jacket. So on one hand, you know, I would like, as a photographer, to capture a portrait, to make a portrait that, you know, represents that author as I have come to know him or her in the amount of time that I had to share with them. So, you know, there are certain things, because I do want to have an honest portrait. I do want that. I do want that image that's on that book jacket to look like the person whom I believe wrote that book, because I think that is a service to all the readers out there. Now, we know that, you know, there are people in various walks of life, in various professions, who would love to have their image something who they really aren't, right? You know, it's a deception, you know, and they'll call it, well, you know, this is marketing, this is sales, this is our spin on this, this is whatever, or they won't even confess to that at all. And, you know, that's a very uncomfortable situation for a portrait artist, for a photographer who does portraits. Given a level playing field, given where I'm not having that sort of pressure to portray something that just really isn't true, then I would like to have an integration of what I see, what I perceive, what I'm able to do as a craftsman, and then what the subject wants. And, you know, what the subject wants is important to me. I do think that's a big part of it. And I think that the thing about portraiture to me, when I think about taking someone's picture, I not only want to capture a flattering but honest way their exterior, but to me, the images that really work, the portraits that really work, are the ones that also show what's inside the person, what's beneath the surface. When I can portray that, then I really feel like I'm successful. Now, you're probably thinking, well, how do you know when you've captured that? And I think that's a really interesting question, because I don't think you can really describe why it does that. You just look at the image and you go, that's you. That's you. It was captured. That is you. That captures who you are to me. And it's just one of those things where you just sort of know it when you see it. And I think even more importantly, when you feel it, you know, when you see that image, you feel something about that person. Now, people come to us as photographers with all sorts of visual baggage, right? And, you know, I've talked about this before when I talk about portraiture. There are things that people don't like about themselves. You know, everybody has something, right? Something that they don't like. Given the opportunity, if you disguise that, or if you hide that, or if you don't emphasize that above everything else, they will like the picture. And, you know, the classic example is the double chin, right? And you know, the double chin has been in the news lately, too. A lot of people really hate having their double chin show. So, a common scenario, one I have seen many times, is that the rest of the picture, in my estimation, could be, you know, very bad, not good at all, but they will love it if it hides their double chin. They are happy with it, and that is the one that they will want to use. So when you're working with somebody in terms of selecting from a group of shots, the one that, you know, is going to be the shot that ends up on their bio page or on their resume, whatever it happens to be, then there is this little tug of war between the things that they don't like about themselves and the things that you as the photographer think objectively this is the best shot. And sometimes the best shot could show a little double chin, but yet far and away be the best shot in terms of, you know, how the eyes look, what the energy of the shot is, the posture, the body language, you know, all these other things that make up the portrait. So that wrestling match is very interesting. Now, even in those situations, though, I really do try to come to a spot where the person is comfortable. In other words, I'm not going to say flat out, you should not run that shot, no matter what. Even though it hides your double chin, the rest of you looks terrible, right? I don't go down that road at all. I go down the road of where we try to find a middle spot. And I think that is, you know, something that's really important in terms of having some sort of compassion, some sort of empathy for the person on the other side of the camera. When you're taking the picture, when you're reviewing the pictures, when you're editing the pictures. Now, folks will want you to do other things. If they're advanced in years, then they may want you to just like eliminate all of their wrinkles. Now, I can understand why someone would want all of their wrinkles gone. Yes, I have wrinkles too. I know how that feels. However, you're not doing a service to the person if you eliminate all the wrinkles, even though they want you to, for obvious reasons. You take away all the wrinkles, you know, they've seen the picture on the website of, say, the business page, whatever. They come to your place of business to meet with you, to work with you, to possibly hire you, and then you look completely different than that shot on your website. They're going to go, hey, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this person. I mean, right away, you have been dishonest to some degree. Now, that doesn't mean you have to show all the wrinkles in full glory either, right? So there is a middle ground where possibly you could soften the wrinkles around the eyes a bit and so forth. You could use diffused lighting to take the shot. You know, don't use harsh side lighting, right? Use diffused lighting. You know, bringing that light more around to the front and having it diffused. Remember the rule of thumb that we use when we're trying to control texture in portraits, which is the larger the light source, the closer to the person, then the softer the light. And generally speaking, the position of that light, the more to the front, the better off that is. So if you're shooting something where you want to show texture, then you use a harsher light and you can move the light back a little bit and put it to the side. That would show a lot of texture. However, if you're trying to downplay someone's texture in their skin, wrinkles, so forth, then you can do that in an honest way just by controlling the lighting. All you're doing is you're bringing a softer light source more to the front and closer to the person. That, in my opinion, is honest. You are showing the person as they are. You're not doing a whole lot of retouching, if any at all. You're choosing a light source that works and yet still shows them as they are. And those are the kind of things that I think, you know, taking a portrait is not a simple thing. I mean, there is a lot of stuff to think about, you know, when you want to do these sort of things. Now, how about the people that do want you to just flat out, you know, go Photoshop crazy on them? Is that a job that you take? Do you refuse to do it? I mean, is that what Winston Churchill was doing when he wanted the portrait to be more flattering? As the story is told, at least in The Crown, in a little bit from the research that I could tell, is that, you know, Churchill and Sutherland spent quite a bit of time together. Sutherland did workup drawings. He did a lot of drawings of his hands. You know, that was an important part to him. There was photographs taken that he could go back to the studio and work with. You know, so there were a number of sittings where they spent time either talking or not talking to each other, depending how it was. And, you know, one of the things that Churchill claimed to have said is that you're not only just painting me, you're painting a statesman who has, you know, served, you know, this great country for many years, and that should be part of it. You know, so not only how I look at 80 years old, but, you know, the stuff that makes me, the stuff that made me who I am, as I served all of those years. That, you know, should help offset maybe my slumped shoulders a bit, maybe my imperfect posture, maybe my excess weight, you know, all those things that we don't like about ourselves. It appears, based on the picture that Sutherland created, that did not count. That those things that Churchill lobbied for did not count to Sutherland. What Sutherland believed should be done is capturing him as he appeared to others physically on his 80th birthday, in his 80th year. And that to him seemed most important. I guess the thinking would be, well, there are other portraits of Churchill all those other years, right? So those portraits can tell the story of him as, you know, a 40-year-old, as 50-year-old, him, you know, standing in front of Parliament, all that kind of stuff. There is plenty of documentation to cover that. What my job as the artist is to capture him as he looks in 80 years of age. And so he took that in a lot of ways. I think he took that literally, right? Literally, that was his approach. Now, whether that's the approach that you want to take or not, well, that depends on you, right? And the whole reason why I'm bringing this up for consideration is, what is your approach? What is your approach when someone asks you to do a portrait of them? If you take the assignment seriously at all, then you're probably going to think about it a little bit beforehand. There are the basic questions, you know, are we doing a studio portrait? Are we doing an outside portrait? You know, what is the lighting going to be? How much am I going to intervene with the lighting? Are we going to do just a natural light portrait? Or are we going to do something where I bring in diffused light source to help, you know, soften the texture? Are we going to do any retouching? How many shots are we going to take? And how much influence do you have on which one is selected? Am I going to show you all the shots? Am I going to show you just the shots that I think are worthy? Or am I going to show you a broader selection of shots, including some of the shots that I don't like that you very well may like? There are a lot of areas there where we have influence over the final outcome. And so since we have so much influence over the final outcome, what is our philosophy as photographers who either take portraits all the time or who take portraits just every now and then? It doesn't make any difference how often you make portraits as to having a philosophy for each portrait that you make. And I think it's worth thinking about. Now, as I said, you know, if it hasn't come through in this rambling about Churchill and Sutherland and so forth, I really have empathy for both men in that scenario. I do understand, you know, Sutherland's desire to be honest in his portrayal of Winston Churchill. And I do understand Churchill's desire to have more than just his physical body in his 80th year be the sole driver of this particular portrait. And I honestly believe that it should be somewhere in the middle. I think that what was portrayed of Churchill in that portrait that was burned was too harsh. I honestly think it was too harsh and did not do the subject the greatest service. Now, would I have wanted to paint it exactly the way Churchill had wanted? You know, great posture, less weight, and all that sort of stuff? No, we're not going to go there either. Because then we're back to what I was talking about earlier, where if you just totally Photoshop the thing and you put it on their webpage and then someone shows up expecting to meet with that person and they see someone who looks completely different, well, that's not right either. And in Churchill's case, that really deviates too far from historical accuracy. So for me personally, I like to take a middle ground where I think that the person's inner self does come into play. The person's desires do have some influence on the shot. But in the end, you know, I need to deliver an image that I'm comfortable with that is close enough to the truth to that if people see it and they see you, they're going to think that they're the same person. Something to think about. I think it's good stuff for us to think about as we take pictures of other people and when they are putting their hearts in our hands during that portrait session. In the news. Well, this was a great week this past week for Fujifilm, wasn't it? Oh my gosh. So on the side, I've talked about some of the other cameras, but I want to talk about the X100F. I've held off talking about that until the podcast. So this is a piece that was reported by DP Review. Fujifilm X100F steps up to 24.3 megapixels and adds AF joystick. And here's what they have to say. Fujifilm is taking the wraps off the X100F, a fourth generation of its popular enthusiast focus compact series. It updates the house that the X100 built with a 24.3 megapixel X-Trans 3 APS-C sensor and X processor Pro image processor borrowed from the X-T2. So for those of you that aren't photographers listening to the show, I know that sounds like a lot of mumble jumble, right? But basically, they upgraded the sensor and the engine that processes the image. Changes can also be seen on the top and rear panels of the camera, notably the AF joystick that makes its first appearance on the X100 series. Other controls have been shifted to the right of the LCD, and up top, the shutter speed dial has been modified to include ISO controls. A front control dial has been added. The hybrid viewfinder has also been updated and now offers image magnification when using the electronic rangefinder mode. So the Fujifilm X100F will be available February 16th in black or silver for $1,299. And this again was reported by DP Review. So this is a terrific camera that just continues to get better. But I think it's very interesting that, you know, this camera is basically up to 24 megapixels now, has a very modern sensor and a very modern processor. So even though it's a fixed lens camera, in other words, the lens that's on there, which is a moderately wide lens, is the lens that you have to shoot with. The nice thing about this, you don't have to worry about sensor dust. You know, you don't have to worry about, you know, any damage that can happen, you know, by changing lenses and all that sort of stuff. It helps keep the camera very compact, and it sort of gets you in a rhythm on how to shoot with this camera, right? You always sort of know. When you put it up to your eye, you know the field of view that you're going to be working with. So there's really something to be said for really understanding how this tool works. At $1,300, it's not a cheap camera, but then again, you know, we had the new Leica come out also last week, the M10, I believe. You know, so that's like $7,000 for the body with no lens. So on one hand, $1,300 is a nice chunk of change. On another hand, well, you know, there are many cameras that cost a lot more. This is a very high quality tool. And if you've kind of wanted a camera for street shooting, for travel, something that you knew exactly what it was going to deliver in terms of, you know, performance, field of view, image quality, all of that, this is really a handsome camera and one that does deliver and in the right of photographer's hands can do amazing things. This next story really validates something that I have been saying in private conversations for some time now. Something that's actually a bit of a nit for me, something that I'm, you know, not happy about for sure. I'll read it to you and I'll do a little commenting. 87% of UK freelance photographers asked to work for free in 2016. 16% of them said yes. And this was reported on Petapixel. Let me read it to you. The issue of businesses asking photographers to work for free has been a hot issue in recent years. And now we have some citable statistics that shed more light on it. According to a new study in the UK, 87% of photographers were asked to work for free in 2016, and 16% of them said yes. The research was conducted by UK startup Approve.io, which surveyed 1,009 part and full-time freelancers in the UK who have taken on freelance contracts over the past 5 years. The study reveals an alarming trend for corporate entitlement when it comes to how freelance professionals are treated, Approve.io tells Petapixel. You can read the entire story on Petapixel, and of course I have the link in the show notes, as I do the link to everything else that I talk about. This is something that I have noticed in my own career and have talked a bit about off and on the podcast, where corporate America seems to be on the path of, you know, really not respecting what we do. And, you know, I know that the democratization of photography has had, you know, a lot to do with this. Technology has had a lot to do with this. People can take pretty pictures, as I talked about last week, with their iPhones, and a lot of times that seems good enough. And it was interesting. I was looking at some restaurants, shopping for some restaurants while I'm on the road right now, by the way, if you haven't figured out by the audio here. Looking for some restaurants for family stuff. And it was interesting, as I looked at the pictures that restaurants had, these are restaurants that want you to come eat their food, restaurants had on their own sites that were, I was going, my gosh, that's a terrible photograph. Why would you put that photograph of your product on your website? And I am seeing this over and over again. I've seen it with hotels. I've seen it with all sorts of businesses displaying subpar photography for their wares. Well, of course, they didn't want to pay for good photography, right? Someone had an iPhone, someone had whatever, and they said, that's good enough. Those pictures will work just fine. And I really have noticed personally, and my friends and family, they tease me about this. They go, you know, just lay off the photography, you know, when we're looking at other sites. But I just can't help it because it just jumps out at me that the proliferation of bad photography. Well, in part, we know what's going on here. And this study tells a big story that corporate America in general, and I'm talking small business America too, are constantly asking us to work for free. And if we won't work for free, then they'll just go ahead and do the shots themselves. And I don't have an answer for this at all or anything, but it certainly confirms something that I've observed. And for those of out there that are trying to make our living through photography or who are freelancers trying to supplement our income, this is a problem that has been growing for some time, and I don't see it changing in the near future. So I guess we better really embrace the artistic side of our work, because that is the one area that we have left. Alrighty, well, that was kind of a downer story, wasn't it? All right, but I got it out of my system, so thank you for bearing with me. All right, I just wanted to let people know who were on the reserve list for the Chicago to New Orleans rail adventure. Those registration forms now have gone out. If you signed up on the reserve list for that workshop and you did not receive a registration form, please send me a note and I'll make sure that you get it. Those of you that now are thinking that that would be kind of a fun workshop to go on, but you weren't on the reserve list, go ahead and jump on the reserve list now, and then you can be part of the second wave of registration invites that go out. And by the way, this workshop, the Chicago to New Orleans Rail Adventure, is June 26th through June 29th, 2017. We start in Chicago. And our workshop starts the day after the Out of Chicago conference, all right? And if you want to have more information about all of this or get on the reserve list, just go to the TDS workshop page. It's on The Digital Story, and there's workshops up there in the nav bar. Big thanks to all of our Patreon members who are helping to support our site. And for those people who have also provided individual donations, outside of Patreon, you know, we have the support page that you can get to on the Digital Story. We can do a one-shot donation, I guess, for lack of a better term here, supporting our efforts. Thanks to everyone. You know, we've had more people kicking in lately, and I just tell you, it helps so much. Our B&H and Amazon tiles on the Digital Story, if you're going to do any shopping at B&H or Amazon, if you would go to our site first, thedigitalstory.com, click on one of those tiles, to take you over to the Amazon or B&H site, then do your shopping. That helps support our site also. And finally, I want to mention our friends at Red River Paper. I just did some fine art card printing last week for some very special occasions. And one of the things that I loved was that when I gave one of the cards, at this occasion, the person loved the card, they loved the picture, they loved what I wrote, all that stuff. But then they go, the paper feels so nice. I go, oh man, do I love hearing that? That is so cool. Because I thought a lot about that paper. And that's what Red River Paper allows you to do. It allows you to create something that not only do you make yourself, not only is it your art that you've created, but it allows you to create your art on paper that feels great, that looks great, and that is precisely the message that you wanted to convey. They have a tile on all the pages of the digital story, and they have a terrific Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. Okay, that's going to do it for me this week. Thank you for listening to this show that was recorded in an undisclosed location somewhere between Northern and Southern California. Visiting family right now. I tell you, I love this little audio recorder, and I kind of like recording on the road. I mean, I prefer the sound of the podcast in the studio, but there's something exciting about doing on the road too. I hope it sounded okay to you. I should be in the studio next week, and I'll see you then. Have a great week. Take some wonderful pictures. Bye-bye now.